She squealed with delight when she saw me, ducked back behind her blanket, and emerged a moment later in her granny dress. I was vaguely disturbed to catch a glimpse of another form on the mattress in the dim recess as Elsa parted the blanket and came out. A twinge of jealousy? Elsa gave me a quick hug of genuine affection, and then offered me a cup of steaming coffee, which she poured from a battered pot on the stove. I gratefully accepted the coffee, for the walk from the bus stop had thoroughly chilled me. We sat on an unoccupied mattress near the stove. The sound from the TV and the noise being made by the crying baby and the two scuffling boys allowed us to talk in relative privacy. We talked of many things, for I didn't want to blurt out immediately the true reason for my visit. I learned a lot about Elsa and the people she's living with. Some of the things I learned saddened me, and some profoundly shocked me. I was saddened by Elsa's story of herself. She is the only child of upper-middle-class parents. Her father is, or was, she hasn't been in touch with her family for more than a year, a speechwriter for one of the most powerful senators in Washington. Her mother is an attorney for a left-wing foundation whose principal activity is buying up houses in white suburban neighborhoods and moving black welfare families into them. Until she was 15, Elsa had been very happy. Her family had lived in Connecticut until then, and Elsa had attended an exclusive private school for girls. Single-sex schools are illegal now, of course. She spent the summers with her parents at their vacation home on the beach. Elsa's face glowed as she described the woods and trails around their summer home and the long walks she took by herself. She had her own little sailboat and often sailed out to a tiny island offshore for private picnics and long, happy hours of lying in the sun and daydreaming. Then the family moved to Washington, and her mother insisted that they take an apartment in a predominantly black neighborhood near Capitol Hill, rather than living in a white suburb. Elsa was one of only four white students at the junior high school to which they sent her. Elsa had developed early. Her natural warmth and open, uninhibited nature combined with her outstanding physical charms to produce a girl who had been extraordinarily attractive sexually even at 15. The result was that the black males, who also continually badgered the one other white girl at the school, gave Elsa no peace. The black girls, seeing this, hated Elsa with special passion and tormented her in every way they could. Elsa dared not go into the restroom or even let herself out of the sight of a teacher for a moment while she was at school. She soon found that the teachers offered no real protection when a black assistant principal cornered her in his office one day and tried to put his hand inside her dress. Each day, Elsa came home from school in tears and begged her parents to send her to another school. Her mother's response was to scream at her, slap her face, and call her a racist. If the black boys were bothering her, it was her fault, not theirs, and she should try harder to make friends with the black girls. Nor did her father offer her any comfort, even when she told him about the incident with the assistant principal. The whole issue embarrassed him, and he didn't want to hear about it. His liberalism was more passive than her mother's, but he was usually intimidated by his thoroughly liberated wife into going along on any matters that touched on race. Even when three young black thugs accosted him on his very doorstep, took his wallet and wristwatch, and then knocked him down and stomped on his eyeglasses, Elsa's mother wouldn't let him call the police and report the robbery. She regarded the very thought of filing a police complaint against blacks as somewhat fascist. Elsa stood it for 3 months, and then she ran away from home. She was taken in by the little commune she is with now, and, having a basically cheerful disposition, she learned to be tolerably happy in her new situation. Then, about a month ago, the trouble arose which led to my meeting her. A new girl, Mary Jane, had joined their group, and there was friction between Elsa and Mary Jane. The boy Elsa was sharing her mattress with at the time had apparently known Mary Jane earlier, before either joined the group, and Mary Jane regarded Elsa as a usurper. Elsa, in turn, resented Mary Jane's none too subtle efforts to entice her boyfriend away. The result was a screaming, clawing, hair-pulling fight between the two one day, which Mary Jane, being the stronger, had won. Elsa had wandered the street for 2 days. That's when I met her. And then she had returned to the basement commune. Mary Jane, meanwhile, had gotten on the wrong side of another of the girls in the group, and Elsa pressed this advantage by issuing an ultimatum. Either Mary Jane must go, or she, Elsa, would leave permanently. Mary Jane had responded by threatening Elsa with a knife. "So what happened?" I asked. "We sold her," was Elsa's simple reply. "You sold her? What do you mean?" I exclaimed. Elsa explained. "Mary Jane refused to leave after everyone sided with me, so we sold her to Cappy the Kike. He gave us the TV and $200 for her." Cappy the Kike, it turned out, is a Jew named Kaplan who makes his living in the white slave trade. He makes regular trips to Washington from New York for the purpose of buying runaway girls. His usual suppliers are the wolf packs, from one of which I had rescued Elsa. These predatory groups snatch girls off the street, keep them for a week or so, and then if their disappearance has caused no comment in the newspapers, sell them to Kaplan. What happens to the girls after that, no one can say with certainty. But it is thought that most are confined in certain exclusive clubs in New York, where the wealthy go to satisfy strange and perverted appetites. Some, it is rumored, are eventually sold to a Satanist cult and painfully dismembered in gruesome rituals. Anyway, someone in the commune had heard that Kaplan was in town and buying, so when Mary Jane wouldn't leave, they tied her up, located Kaplan, and made the sale. I had thought I was unshockable, but I was horrified by Elsa's story of Mary Jane's fate. "How," I asked in a tone of outrage, "could you sell a white girl to a Jew?" Elsa was embarrassed by my obvious displeasure. She admitted that it was a terrible thing to have done and that she sometimes feels guilty when she thinks about Mary Jane. But it had seemed like a convenient solution to the commune's problem at the time. She offered the feeble excuse that it happens all the time, that the authorities apparently know all about it and don't interfere, and so it is really more society's fault than anyone's.